the OTB Podcast Network.
OTB Gold, the very best of Off the Ball.
Are you crazy?
This is OTB Sports Radio.
Are you a complete rookie? What are you talking about? Are you out of your mind? Are you crazy?
Absolutely brilliant maneuver by Mansell. Fantastically brilliant.
It's been a hell of a life and a career, yeah. Thank you for giving me this platform to announce my retirement.
Westwood lead 2-13 to 2-8.
The treatment was tough. You were given every encouragement and every chance to survive.
When I was 13, 14, I was playing on about 13, 14 teams at the time.
OTB Gold, the very best of Off the Ball. Weekdays from 1 p.m. and 6 p.m.
OTB Sports Radio, live 24/7 on the Go Loud app.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Now, you're very welcome back. We are chatting through the Sunday Papers. Very happy to welcome Colm Keyes from the Irish Independent and Cliona Foley, sports journalist, presenter of the Off the Bench podcast as well. Guys, thanks for joining us. I'll start with the headlines. Well, three guesses is just universal coverage. So, back pages of the Sunday World, firstly, it's a picture of Jack Charlton at Italia 90. The nation owes a debt. And the thing is, he's on a lot of the front pages as well. Thanks for the memories, Big Jack, is the Sunday World front page. Then we have the Sunday Mirror next. Thanks for the memories, big man, is the headline on the back page. Tributes pour in for legend who inspired a generation. And then front page again. This is front and back page news all the way. Thanks, Big Jack, you made us dare to dream, is their front page lead on the Mirror. The Sunday Times main section has a very nice black and white profile pic of Charlton, and it's tributes to Big Jack, forever part of Irish folklore. The Mail, they have a pull-out section as well as their main coverage. Again, it's that picture of Charlton pointing to the crowd at Italia 90 in that evening game against Italy. Green Giant, the English World Cup winner who became an Irish national treasure. Sunday Independent front page, not their sports section, similar picture, that one at Italia 90 in the La Favorita Stadium. And it's the man who lifted the nation, and beneath that it's Declan Lynch writing about how they were the best of times. Italia 90 was the best thing that ever happened in the history of Ireland. That's not a debating point. It's just the truth. The only thing up for discussion today is whether it would have happened without Big Jack. And no is the answer to that one. Sun Sport then. Brilliant picture. Black and white photo if you're listening on the radio of Charlton nicely dressed up and pint of Guinness in hand and a big smile. Jack Charlton, an English hero who became an Irish legend and lifted a nation. Cheers, Jack. Ireland came together last night to raise a glass to Charlton, who sadly passed away on Friday. Sunday Independent sports section. I gave you the news section a moment ago, but the sports section, they go with that. I mean, in some ways, I mean, a lot of us maybe had forgotten it, but it was that beautiful moment before the England-Ireland friendly where Charlton came out and waved to the crowd a number of years ago. Jack changed everything, the headline. He was very English, but you felt he knew what it was like to be Irish. That's Eamon Sweeney's piece there on the front page. And beneath that, Sam Wallace. Complicated brotherly relationship impacted both Jack and Bobby. Sunday Times sports section. Again, great photo. Jack Charlton, very relaxed. The peaked cap on. Looks like the he's out fishing or hunting or doing something, but a pint of Guinness in hand. And a big smile, it's the whole front page. And then the Mail on Sunday, again, front pages and back pages. He brought unimagined joy to many, many lives. Happiness is his legacy. That's the Mail front page. And then the back page, thanks for the memories. And another picture of Charlton, this time looking a bit more reflective. So, Cliona, there aren't many figures who will get that level of coverage. It's a national weekend of mourning, maybe is too strong. He 85 years of age and lived a phenomenal life. There was great sadness, but it's a weekend of nostalgia and celebration and reminiscing.
Yeah, and there's some really lovely pieces. It's very striking to hear players, international players, talking about loving their international manager. I think that's very unusual, and it's a word that's used by so many of them over the last few days. Mick McCarthy, John Aldridge, Paul McGrath, Niall Quinn, even in today's papers. I think that's very unusual because normally, you know your club manager so much better. But, you know, that is striking. And for me, probably the most touching piece today, and it's, it's an exclusive because he does a column for them, is Paul McGrath in the Sunday World, which I really liked. And if I could just start, you showed at the beginning of it, he said, isn't it the most lovely tribute to a man that within minutes of hearing of the death of Jack Charlton, my phone lit up with the numbers of my children. One by one they rang, all adults now, but remembering 30 years ago when they were children, how Jack would take them down to the beach to play when they were in the middle of the 1990, when we were in the middle of the 1990 World Cup. He said, yes, Ireland's manager thought nothing of taking the kids of one of his players onto the beach to play football, play chasing, buy them ice creams and wind them up that their dad was going to be dropped for the next game. And it's a really lovely piece. And I think probably there, McGrath and Charlton are the two people that we all feel probably most affection for from that era as well.
Mm. Colin, what jumps out at you in an overall sense about the coverage? We'll dig into some of the other pieces in a moment.
Just a deluge of it, Joan. Where this man is in all our lives, really, it's just so much of it, the sheer volume of coverage and the fact that, you know, he makes the front pages of all the papers and in some cases the entirety of the front pages. It really jumps out to me, the enormity of the man. Maybe I didn't even appreciate it now, until now, just how big a figure he was, not just in a sporting sense, but almost in a social and cultural sense as well. And I'm not exaggerating there when I read Declan Lynch's piece this morning, and he poses that question in the first paragraph and says it was the greatest thing that ever happened to the country. And it makes you stop and think, well, what was actually better for those that lived through it and for those that experienced those few weeks of Italia 90? And the communal gathering of people. I could stand to be corrected on this, but I don't remember gatherings and congregations and pubs on such a scale before that to watch sporting events in this country. I can't remember for an All-Ireland final or for a rugby international, possibly a little bit of racing, but not on that scale. Mm. So in terms of getting people out and circulating as they did in those few weeks, it really did change anything, and some of the papers have touched on that. I've read through numerous pieces, and you can take pieces from them all and build a picture of Jack Charlton's personality as much as his substance over style consideration when it came to tactics, but just his personality. And on page 2 and 3 of the Sunday Independent, Paul Kimmage has written about his sensitivity. And one of the lines I love on this is, and Paul has spoken to, he's a very ordinary man, obviously, and that's reflected in all the pieces. And Paul has spoken to Tony Cascarino a few days ago, where he teed him up that it wasn't looking good for Jack. And then yesterday as well, just to recap. But he concludes the piece with going back to the 20-year anniversary. The team went back to Rome in 2010, and after visiting the Spanish Steps, they decide to go to a restaurant, and it's Jack's choice. Where does he want to bring the team? And of all the great restaurants and all the great places Jack could have brought them, he opted for McDonald's, and I think that probably reflects the simplicity of the man. He was straight. He was an ordinary man. Michael Foley put it in his piece on page 2 of the Sunday Times. He was always an independent spirit, a straight-talking fundamentalist who didn't indulge in the fashion of the 60s. And I think that carries across in so many of the pieces. One thing that struck me about him was, and again, it serves as a reminder, is I couldn't believe he was 29 when he made his debut as an English international. I really couldn't believe that. I would have had it at mid-20s, but at 29. That's hard to believe. But personality, as much as sporting philosophy, comes across in so many of the pieces today.
Yeah. The theme of Paul Kimmage's piece, seeing as you mentioned that, A Man More Sensitive Than Ruthless, is the headline. And Paul is jumping back and forth from a conversation he's having with Tony Cascarino now, and also to a day he spent with Jack back in 1998 on the eve of the World Cup. And there's bedlam around the house, and Charlton is half-shaving, kids running everywhere, grandkids. And he's on the phone as well, screaming down the phone, doing another interview, and he's going to a radio station to record an ad. And in the midst of it, there's a story that Cascarino tells, and I think Cascarino tells it in his own piece in the Sunday Times as well. But it's along this theme of, you know, more sensitivity than we might realise. And so it was Cassie says, he first introduced me to Jack And Cass told a story. It started with build up to an Ireland game. They were sitting with a group playing cards in front of the telly, group of players. There was me, he says, John Sheridan, Terry Phelan, Dennis Irwin. And Burt Reynolds popped up in the telly wearing a wig. And Cascarino says, I started laughing. Have a look at Burt's syrup, which is Cockney slang for a wig. And Cascarino says, I had a thing about wigs. My dad had one and I could spot them a mile away. Out of nowhere, Jack just went for me. It was like he had a machine gun. You effer. My kid brother had a sweep over and had people like you taking the piss out of him. Have you any effing idea what it is to lose your hair? Have you any effing idea how hard that is? Cascarino says it was a side to him I'd never seen before, a caring, sensitive side, and I get the benefit of seeing it many times again.
And there's a lovely, I think Paul Kemmage's piece captures that he was very, he loved children, clearly. He loved his own grandchildren, but he was good with everybody's children, which I thought was really interesting with the McGrath thing. There's a lovely, Cascarino's own piece in the Sunday Times, Joe, is a lovely piece as well. Mm. And there's a very telling line in it, I think, which is the one where he says, his biggest attribute as a manager was that he treated the team like men. And I think that, you know, even in GAA at the moment, you look at how players are treated, and I always, it sometimes strikes me that they're not treated like adults, that they're, you know, that they're treated as if they're bold children or something, that they're not respected enough as adults and let make their own minds up about things. And I think that's a really interesting one. And that's a lovely, the Cascarino piece is a lovely piece, but there's brilliant pieces through all the papers, actually. There isn't really a bad piece on any of them. Philip Quinn has a lovely piece in the Mail. Neil O'Riordan and Miguel Delaney have lovely pieces as well. And Philip Quinn quotes Jimmy McGee, which is a line I hadn't heard before, and it's a really nice line. And he said of Charlton, he got honesty out of his players and gave honesty to the fans. The ledger is there for all to see.
Mm. And just one of the things in Paul Kimmage's piece that I noted was, you know, his work ethic. This was this day spent with Jack was 2 years. I think it was around the World Cup in 98. And it was 2 years after he had stepped down as Irish manager. So he's in his early to mid-60s at this point, and he's still working, and he has a very, very busy schedule. And Paul asks him, you know, you don't have to work. Why should you continue on? And he says, basically, I wouldn't want it any other way. But that's the point I counter. You wouldn't want to. No, you like being busy. You enjoy it. I enjoy what I'm doing. I suppose there's two things there. Jack, he had a strong work ethic given his background, and that's another thing that came across in several of the pieces, but most particularly this one, that there was a, you know, this story was that Paul narrates this through his working day and all the schedule. He was on a train to London. He had to go back up to, it was a pretty busy schedule that he had, and this is, he's almost a month on the road in this. So it reflects a work ethic as much as the sensitivity, and that's something that probably reflects in Philip Quinn's piece, although Philip does mention his frugality as well, which was something. His reputation for minding his money surfaced as Irish manager when he cadged pints and fans from Irish journalists in return for pointers about the team he was likely to pick. More than once, the Ireland manager scribbled out his best 11 or his 11 on a beer mat of a Sunday night at the Dublin Airport Hotel. Now, some would dispute that he was like that. There were other journalists of that era says, well, no, maybe he wasn't just as bad as that, but that's what Philip commits to and remembers about him too.
On your point, yeah, sorry, Cliona, yeah.
One other thing that struck me as well was that in quite a few pieces from the former players, they do make this distinction that even though the style was a long ball up, that actually he was brilliant tactically, and that he's that pressure. I mean, we all know the cliche and the songs and everything. We all sang them, put him under pressure. Paul McGrath and John Aldridge, both in the Sunday World, are very strong on that and point out that, you know, that pressing game that they played when they got the ball up, you know, how good that was, and also how he could switch tactically, and how actually he was a very clever manager. And they give various examples, people can read them themselves, of how he did that. And so, you know, it's not as simplistic to think that he played a certain style. There'd be people who would have issues, obviously, with the way he played, issues with the way he treated Liam Brady. You know, there, all of that is covered as well today. So there's a very, I think, fair and honest assessment of him, but it's very interesting to get the players' insights. You know, we have so many former players playing now, but this was a great example able to get real personal insight from them, and I think we really get that today in the papers.
Yeah, and to that end, Cascarino says, Jack believed in simplicity, whether in life or football. He didn't want first-class travel or luxurious accommodation. And I did see, there's a documentary on YouTube last night about the Charlton brothers, and it does seem Jack was very much, you know, a pint in the local pub and fishing and shooting and you know, simple pleasures. And Bobby would be more golf and dinner at the Savoy if he could, and that bit more introspective. But Cascarino goes on to say he hated all that stuff. He loved everything being against the odds, and he injected that into the Ireland team, which was the perfect outlet for him. By that stage, he didn't want to be around footballers 24/7. For Italia 90, we travelled second class. We stayed in a hotel in Sicily where the running water was rust-coloured and there was no air conditioning. I was sharing a room with Andy Townsend. At one point, we were lying there watching a slow ceiling fan going round and round, saying it was like Apocalypse Now. You've got a bed. It's fine. Get on with it. And later on, you know, he talks about the sensitive side some more. So that story about being acutely aware of how difficult it might have been for his brother to go bald so young. He's got a sensitive side, and Jack, if he liked you, he says he'd protect you. He protected Paul McGrath like no other manager would. We would have a meeting about Paul without Paul being there, and he would say, Paul is ill, he's a serious problem, and the point being, we need to help him. At the end of the era, he says, Jack says, our legs were gone. He told us our legs were gone, and so we can't play like we used to, because none of you can run like you used to. That's an interesting point, because the general consensus is, well, the tactics got found out to an extent and they were worked out, and maybe that was part of it. But equally, it's interesting, Jack's feeling was, well, the players didn't have the legs to carry it out with the same ferocity, maybe. Although, in the preparations for that playoff against the Dutch, we were all laughing because we were shown a video and we realised it wasn't the Dutch team that we were watching, it was the Dutch under-21s. And Jack said, just effing watch it. They all play the same way. So Cascarino's piece is really worth reading. Like Kevin Mitchell in The Observer has a good line. He was Ireland's favourite Englishman. He was Leeds' favourite Geordie. And with due respect to his illustrious brother, Jack was nearly everyone's favourite Charlton. And that does come across as well, that, you know, the two brothers, this incredible thing of Jackie Milburn's, you know, relations, and their father, no interest in football whatsoever, but their mother, Sissy, hugely into football, and they go on and win a World Cup together, and there is the fallout, and it's very public, and Jack writes about it in his autobiography in the mid-90s and accuses Bobby and Norma of, you know, maybe not giving enough time to their mother. And naturally, Bobby Charlton's livid at this, and Jack is livid at what he feels is a fair accusation, and there is this terrible rift. I don't know if you saw on Twitter or on social media last night, either of you, when their BBC Sports Personality of the Year award has been presented to Bobby Charlton, and it's Jack who's there. And yeah. And Jack, you know, Bobby Charlton's the best player I've ever seen, aren't you, our kid? It's just an incredible moment, and
Bobby bows the head.
He can't even fully look at him. Yeah.
Put it down, and it's almost as if there's regret there over the split that did come between them. But that was maybe a getting together. The fact that Jack was on stage to present him with that, I'm not sure the history, and there is a lot about that in today's papers, and about the split, and about the different personalities. But that particular moment was captured very well. I did see that. And the head bowing moment was quite poignant.
Yeah, it was lovely.
And Rod Little in the Times, and that Sam Wallace piece in the Independent are both make the point as well about how interesting it was that he applied for the England job, never got it, and that he would always have been an anti-establishment. He was a gruff Northerner. He would have never been what you know, the English FA could have dealt with. And Rod Little says, I wish he had managed England. He applied like Cloughy. He was too northern, too brusque, too independent, too good, which is an interesting line in them as well.
There are different aspects to the Charlton conversation. Obviously, you talk about him and what he brought to it, and the players do brilliant pieces. Eamon Sweeney and Declan Lynch almost capture a little bit of the broader picture and the relationship between Jack and the team and Ireland at that time. And he's writing here on the front page of the Sunday Independent and talking about Ireland in the 80s and Irish football in the 80s being terrible, and this miserable prognosis mirrored the feeling in the country as a whole, racked by high unemployment, massive levels of emigration, social conservatism, stagnant party politics. Mid-80s Ireland felt like a failed state. there was a pervading sense that everything about the country was second rate, and that to be Irish was to have won the booby prize in the lottery of life. Goes on to say later on, Jack provided us with a novel opportunity to feel good about ourselves. And this maybe is your point as well, Colm. Imparted a taste for jubilation we've never lost since. You know, the point you're making about the pubs and get-togethers. He says, even the contrast between the drab, listless atmosphere which prevailed at the half-empty GAA grounds of the 1980s and the vibrant, colourful, fanatical spectacle of the following decade owed a lot to the energies released by the Charlton era. He changed everything. And I do think, even having gone to 2012 or 2016, there is no doubt that it's my generation's chance to get their Italia 90. You know, that's left such a mark, and it's so iconic, and we've grown up watching the documentaries, that I think whenever Ireland get to a tournament now, there is a sense of releasing the Charlton energy again.
And it's almost that people now must honour Italia 90, yeah, and how they celebrated and how they greet it and how they embrace it. The famous Con Hoolihan line that he missed the World Cup because he was in Italy. It was all happening back home around then. And I also think, if you think of the wearing of jerseys in a sporting context, at sports events, certainly in Ireland, there was pre-Italia 90, there wasn't so much of it and on terraces and in stands. And even then, obviously, it followed on from pubs. So the purchasing of a team jersey, and it even followed on into GAA throughout the early 90s as sponsorship, and obviously that developed it a little bit more. But the wearing of jerseys, it wasn't that common before Italia 90, to the best of my memory too. But after that, Opel obviously kicked off and pushed it on, and jerseys became commonplace, and everybody wore them to games, and everybody wore them down to the local pub. So there was that. But so many of the pictures in the papers today have pint in hand, and they really did go hand in hand with Jack Charlton too, because as I recall, Jack Charlton sighting in a pub was like a moving statue at the time. There was so much of it, so much rumour Jack Charlton's in a local pub. And more often than not, he would be, because he was that type of person where he would ordinarily just pull in off a road, could be going on a fishing trip down the country, and in he would go. But it was very commonplace to hear a rumour, oh, Jack Charlton has been in some local pub, and that used to take off, as I said, a little bit like a moving statue.
Yeah.
It struck me, Joe, even during the COVID, it's the only time since that I have seen streets as deserted as they were in 1990. Anybody who was lucky enough and old enough to have been there at the time and watching the games in Ireland and just seen, you know, how the country reacted. Colin mentioned it earlier, you know, because people were taking time off work to go to matches. But when Ireland played, I remember walking down O'Connell Street going home to watch a match at the time, and there was nobody on the streets. And then we remember people, you know, we had all those scenes where people were jumping into fountains, you know, the horns blaring, people just going up and down the streets blaring horns after Ireland games. That was the first time we'd ever seen anything like it. And it struck me, looking at the bare streets in Dublin and in Cork recently, that was the first time I had seen streets deserted since the whole country was in watching the Italia 90.
Well, it's funny, Con Hoolihan is reprinted in the Sunday World on page 69, and he talks about Stuttgart and the next morning Dublin being aglow. As I went to work about 7, I was accosted by perfect and imperfect strangers. The chorus line was, "Isn't it great?" And it was. On a heady Sunday afternoon in Stuttgart, the Republic of Ireland's football came of age. And he goes on later on to talk about Italia 90. Coleman Doyle took a picture of O'Connell Street from the bridge at halftime in a game. That great thoroughfare was deserted, except for a lone man standing at a bus stop, blissfully unaware that normal life was on hold. And Con Hoolihan's final line of Jack is, "He was the first and deepest Anglo-Irish agreement," which is such a good line.
It's great.
In Ross Whittaker's documentary, it's less reflected here, but you touched on it maybe in terms of the jersey-wearing column, but even the tricolour was reclaimed under Jack. Like it's an incredible time when you think about it, that an Englishman is leading this charge, and the tricolour up until Jack and the success meant IRA, it meant republicanism.
Very much so, yeah. And they hung out of houses everywhere in that era too. And there was certainly, it was almost a planting of the flag by Jack Charlton, an Englishman from the north of England. It's quite incredible that was something that was reflective of the era too, that the flag became more commonplace in a sporting context.
Mm. It's something Eamon Sweeney touches on. He says, the manager's I'm just winging it persona endeared him to a nation which had raised self-deprecation to the level of art form. But he goes on to say, Jack's upbringing in one of those north of England mining communities where the centres of power in London seem almost as alien as they do to an Irishman gave him an outsider status, a status which was cemented by his time with Leeds as the pantomime villains of English football. He says, Jack Charlton did not seem foreign to us in the way that someone like Terry Venables or Bobby Robson would have done. He was very English, but you felt he knew what it was like to be Irish. And he goes on later on to say, his awkwardness and lack of polish struck a chord in a country where such qualities were regarded as indicators of authenticity and sincerity. He suited us and we suited him, which I think captures it brilliantly. I remember this as a child, so I've only looked at it back through the prism of reeling in the years and not experiencing it in real time. He is incredibly unpolished, Cliona, incredibly gruff at times, and yet incredibly charismatic.
And also incredibly articulate. I always remember, I think it was the 1991, the one in College Green on the stage where he said, I think the line was, we ate well and we drank little. And he said, he stopped and he said, we'll change that tonight. And I remember thinking, oh my God, how could you even come up with that? You know what I mean? In front of 500,000 people. It was just, he was very gruff, he was also very articulate. And that comes across in some of the pieces today. And that Eamon Sweeney piece and what Colm is saying about that reclaiming is so true about the tricolour and about that, you know, really his placement. The fact that he loved fishing, the fact that he loved those country pursuits, you know, the fact that he when we said he was English, he didn't seem like, you know, a certain type of English person to us. You know, he seemed more like us. And Paul McGrath makes that point, you know, he says he got the Irish psyche. You know, Trapattoni, he said, never got the Irish psyche. It may not even have been a language thing, but Jack actually got the Irish psyche, and so he knew how to manage people. But, you know, I was often struck by that, and even when he was interviewed, how easy and relaxed he was. And then he could come out with a line, and you'd go, wow, you know. He had this gruff northern exterior, but he was a very, very smart man. I think that's sometimes missed. And the same thing that Aldridge is saying today and McGrath about tactically, about what he could do tactically. You know, people misinterpret him, and he liked to play that line, as Eamon Sweeney is saying, about the, you know, the underdog and, you know, the kind of, you know, gruff northerner. But he was a very smart man as well. And so isn't it lovely that he had 2015, he had that friendly in 2015, I think Neil O'Riordan, I think, says it as well today, you know, or Miguel Delaney, you know, where three, four words, you know, he walked out in the field and they were ole, ole, ole. And that's just such, it's great that he had that. Mm. And so how much he was appreciated before he died.
I just have to mention the back page of the Sunday World, the nation owes a debt, and that's probably obviously a play on the nation holds its breath, and it probably captures that a nation does owe a debt, and it, you know, feeds into what we've been saying about the, you know, the social and cultural changes out of it too. But he really was an ordinary man, and that bluntness really endeared him to people here. Mm. Having said all that, by 1996, I think the general feeling was that he should move on, and that there was that great tactical debate throughout the 90s, probably after the World Cup in 1990. And ironically, Eamon Dunphy, who led the charge, is on the front page, quoted on the front page of the Sunday Independent. But there was a bit of hostility towards Jack towards the latter end, that the team wasn't really fulfilling his potential. And, you know, maybe that's not for today's papers to reflect on in the greater scheme of things. But I think by 1994 and into the 1996 campaign, while Jack said the legs were gone, there was a feeling that the team were not fulfilling their potential as a group of footballers, and that maybe his tactics had been overplayed. And that's not reflected in any of these pieces, but I'm sure it will be. Again, it's probably not the place and not the time. And the greater sentiment is a nation owes a debt, and there is no doubt about that either. But with the passing of time, I think we've seen the enormity of his contribution to sport, and that's reflected in that he has bumped off so much off the front pages, so much else.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with everything you said there, and about the latter years and Austria and the Harry Ramsden challenge and a sense that things were getting away a bit. That all happened, but it doesn't really diminish what he achieved at all, because it was so spectacular. Neil O'Riordan has a great piece in the Sun and touches on different things that aren't necessarily reflected elsewhere. Like, he reminds us that in 1967 he was the Football Writer's Footballer of the Year. You know, this is a guy that seemed to be going nowhere and hadn't been capped by England until he was 29. But he was Footballer of the Year, Football Writer's Footballer of the Year in 67, which had been won by his brother Bobby the year before. And in the documentary last night, he's talking to Colm Meaney in it, the Charlton years, and Don Revie had given him a list of things he had to be in charge of when he joined Middlesbrough as manager. And he gave it to the board, and they said, you can't be in charge of all this stuff. And he said, well, you've 20 minutes and I'm in charge of all this stuff or I'm leaving. And they agreed to everything. But Neil O'Riordan points out that one of the things he also had in his contract was that he gets 3 days off per week to allow him indulge in shooting and fishing. Unconventional it may have been, but it worked and they got promoted. And there's something else he mentions again. I hadn't realised this. His attempt in the dressing room at half-time of a game against England to get the Irish under-19 team to play in the same way as his senior side prompted Liam Toohey and Brian Kerr to quit in protest at being underwhelmed. This was unlikely to have troubled him. He also goes on to say that Jack and Billy Bingham once were on an FA coaching course when they were still in their mid-20s. And its director of coaching, Alan Wade, was pulled up in the middle of a session and bluntly told that his ideas were wrong. And Neil mentions as well, you know, the treatment of David O'Leary and Liam Brady, that was drowned out by celebrations at never before seen results. So there is complexity to the picture, which is, I think, good as well in the pieces. But that's a really good read.
Yeah.
And just one other quick one to mention, Cliona, and it ties in with your point. Have either of you heard the Desert Island Discs he did back in 96?
No, I've never heard it. It's referred to by a few people, actually. Yeah.
I think we'll need to, because he talks in that about going to the World Cup in Mexico, and he says it was like peas in a pod. He was working for TV in Mexico, peas in a pod. Everybody played the same way through a playmaker in midfield, and unless the playmaker was in a good position to go at the back four, nobody would commit themselves forward. And then Miguel Delaney writes, so Ireland therefore would commit themselves forward. His ultimate point is that Miguel Delaney's point here in the Sunday Independent, Clean, is the one you made, is that he went to Mexico 86. He said he had seen nothing new, which Miguel Delaney calls a remarkable statement for a competition that saw Maradona reach historic peaks.
Yeah.
But he points out Charlton wasn't looking at the game that way. He was looking at it in a different way to anyone. And it was you know, this that initially helped a limited player become a pillar for England. Just the sense that he saw the game very well at that time and came away from Mexico 86 and looked around and thought, well, this is the way to crack all these teams. And maybe we underestimate that aspect of things. It's not just boot the ball.
Yeah, there's a very, I retweeted today a very good piece by Simon Hattleston in The Guardian. And he did a piece and he was coming at it, it's a really good piece. It was about the 1966 team in England. But he tried to interview the whole team, and it's really well worth having a look at. He has tweeted it himself. But he says his chat with Jack in it is very interesting, particularly interesting as well. But it's a really good piece, and he was saying he was so warm and generous and honest. And I just think that's a really fascinating insight into him in terms of England in the 1966 team and where he came and how he compared to the rest of the team. And, you know, some people were rung up and wouldn't do interviews, and some looked for money, and then he went off and he met Jack. And it's just an extra little piece of reading for people like the Desert Island, this one, which I'll definitely have to go and listen to now, because apparently it was brilliant. Yeah.
It's actually mentioned in the context of the divide between Bobby and himself in Sam Wallace's piece in the Sunday Independent as well. I was looking back at Graeme Souness's piece, and he draw a comparison with Jock Stein and Jack Charlton, which was an interesting one for me, because he was severe on me, Graeme. This is obviously relating to the time in Middlesbrough.
Yeah.
And he says he was severe on me, but I could think that was because he could see someone who had a chance of doing something. He would take the mickey out of me, a bit like Jock did, slagging off my gear or my hair. I used to turn up with the shampoo and conditioner and the hairdryer, and Jack would laugh at that. But he was hard on people, but that was to try and get the best out of them. And that's something that Souness reflects in his piece in the Sunday Times too.
Yeah. Eamon Dunphy is on page 3 of the Sunday Independent. Wayne O'Connor is writing this piece and tells a good story. When we drew at Russia in 88, I'd flown out. I was staying in the same hotel as them. Jack saw me at the bar. He was going in for a meal. The team had its own private dining room, and he came over with Mick Byrne and Morris Setters, and he said, "Are you on your own?" I said I was, and he said, "Why don't you have dinner with us?" I said, "Jack, are you mad?" I had been critical of the players under the previous manager, especially people like Mick McCarthy and Frank Stapleton. I said, "Jack, they'll go effing mad." Jack said, "Ah, F them. You're coming with me." He grabbed a hold of me and dragged me into the private room. Mick McCarthy and Frank Stapleton got up and walked out of the room. I said, "I told you, Jack." He said, "Get in there and eat your dinner." And Dunphy says he was a force of nature. And concludes kind of brilliantly as we wrap up the Jack chat, I guess, because we've done plenty on it. But Dunphy says, "I think Jack should be remembered for bringing a lot of pride and joy to the country. His team's always behaved impeccably as well, whether they won or lost. Jack and what he did touched something profound in the Irish psyche. It was to do with emigration, losing and not standing on your own two feet. Culture matters so much, and this is popular culture at its most powerful," which is a typically kind of interesting Dunphy thing to say.
I think, Joe, that relationship with the diaspora and the recruitment of players, while that may not have sat easily with some, and I would say very, very few, it very much happened on his watch. And, you know, Ireland, obviously, through the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, was ravaged with emigration, and the soccer team was able to touch on that base and bring some of that back. And it happened on Jack Charlton's watch too. So that's another important part of the legacy too, that he was very much behind that, and that these were parents or their parents and grandparents. And while it's scorned upon in some respects, and obviously it is in England, it was an important feature. And obviously Houghton and Aldridge were key to that in the very early stages of Jack's reign. Yeah. So that's an important part of that legacy.
It's such an interesting legacy because, like, none of these things were conscious or engineered on his part. He didn't look at the tricolour and say, "We need to reclaim this from the IRA. He didn't look at the diaspora and say, "We need to connect with, you know, the lost sons and grandsons of emigrants." He was purely pragmatic on that front. And yet, you know, when we look back on it, there was something strange happening. He didn't see himself as an Englishman and some kind of Anglo-Irish, you know, barometer. And yet all of that was part of the story.
And also, he didn't say, "We have to make people..." That wasn't... It was an offshoot of it. "We have to make people feel better about themselves."
Yeah.
And people did feel better about themselves.
Well, listen, that's the Jack Charlton coverage. It's absolutely everywhere, and there's lots of just fantastic, brilliant pieces in it. We'll take a short break and we'll get to the other stories in the papers with Cliona Foley and Colm Keyes in just a moment. Welcome back. We're reviewing the Sunday papers. We have Cliona Foley and Colm Keyes with us. Lots of texts coming in. Mark in Limerick: "The country's littered with cheques signed by Charlton. He paid for everything by cheque. They were very often framed and hung on the walls. There's one in a local pub near here. Never cashed. Dog Wise was our Jack. Saved a fortune." Shane says, "I'd like to start a petition now to erect a statue of Jack on the Walkinstown roundabout forever. Thankful." Well, certainly somewhere. There's a beautiful one in Cork Airport. Really natural one, where he's sitting there fishing. He's got I don't know, does he have a fish in hand? But it's clearly Jack fishing somewhere, kind of a statue in Cork Airport. But I think we don't have any outside the Aviva. And really, it's probably high time. Lads, Jack's time at Middlesbrough was kind of overshadowed yesterday. But one of the things most impressive about his time there was the fact he won Manager of the Year in England despite managing in the second division for that season. Interested to hear Graeme's recollections later on, says TC in Dublin. I didn't realise that. We'll talk to Graeme Souness after the paper review. Amongst other things, he remembers the smell in Jack's car being horrendous because there'd be animals in there, dead animals for days, sometimes from his hunting, and the stench, according to Graeme Souness, was horrific. Declan says, "Ireland were struggling under Jack early on. Fans and the press were beginning to get in his back. My brother Niall wrote into the Irish Independent supporting Jack and saying we could still qualify for Euro 88. 3 days later, a letter arrived signed by Jack thanking him for his support, telling him to keep faith and we would qualify. What a lovely gesture that was by Jack, and it made my brother's day." Amazing. That's a hell of a letter. I hope you kept it. And actually, I meant to say, it's not in the papers, but his parents and the relationship and the family are just so interesting. And in that Charlton Brothers documentary, extraordinary as it is, for the 1966 semi-final, and, you know, to do some blunt psychology here, for Bobby, you can read their father, quiet, understated, introspective, didn't like the limelight. For their mother, you can read Jack, loved the limelight, loved the fun, loved the pageantry, the whole thing. The 1966 World Cup semi-final, England against Portugal, his two sons playing in the game, their father went to work down the mine and missed the game. Bobby scored a goal, England get to the final. That night on BBC, David Coleman comes on the TV and they replay the game specifically for Mr. Charlton, which is just, you know, incredible. And I hadn't ever heard that story before. Thank God somebody made the parents go to the final. Word got through and they said, right, well, you both have to go to the final. And I see Dan McDonald, by the way, is digging into the archives. He just tweeted this from the Sunday Independent 1986. So technically we'll let it qualify for the pay-per-view. And it starts off with Jack Charlton saying, "I hate this bloody hotel," says Jack Charlton, sitting in room 402 of the Westbury. "A deeply plush hotel, purpose-built to provide all known creature comforts for the wealthy passing trade." Charlton says, "I'm not paying for it, though, so I shouldn't complain. And I'm not. It's very comfortable. But I hate hotels that charge too much. And they all charge too much." The start of that interview. I need to read the rest of that, I think.
What Tony Cascarino was saying in his piece about he liked the simple things, simple things in life. And that reflects that, what Dan put up in the last few hours.
So that's Jack Charlton. And I suspect there'll probably be more Jack Charlton pieces even in a week. Kleena, let's go something totally, totally different. Other end of the spectrum completely. There are two interconnected pieces. In the Mail on Sunday, and actually I checked online, this is a much bigger splash in the Mail on Sunday. Yeah, so if you're in the UK and you're buying the Mail on Sunday there, this is like a two-page humongous story, big spread, big scandal. This has the potential to be a big talking point and a big deal over there. Obviously, Jack Charlton coverage has taken up much of the space in the paper today over here. So it's about what happened at the 2012 Olympics, which, by the way, increasingly are just feeling like one of the dirtiest Olympics we've seen. I mean, it's just been a litany of bad stories from that Games over the last 8 years. So it's we'll come to Tommy Collins' piece in a moment, which is linked to it. But tell us in the gist of what seems to have happened to GB athletes in 2012.
Yeah, this is a Mail investigation, as you say. Even or if anybody has an online subscription, they'll see that on the English Mail, it's a big spread of a story. But even in the Irish version, basically what they have discovered is that UK Sport, which would be the equivalent of, you know, the Sports Council in Ireland, or Sport Ireland as they're now called, and they're funded by the National Lottery, that before 2012 they enrolled 91 British Olympians to take an experimental substance that had never been tested in competition previously. It wasn't an illegal thing. It was a ketones, a synthetic version of naturally occurring body acid. But Oxford University were doing some testing with it, and they were getting athletes to use it. And more interestingly, on top of that, they were getting them to sign non-disclosure things, NDAs about using it. So they basically were signing gagging orders, even though they were experimenting of this stuff. And in the 2012 experiment, 28 of the 91 athletes using the substance, it was in a form of a drink form, and they had nasty side effects, including vomiting and gastrointestinal upsets. And just in this piece alone, Jo Pavey, and it's interesting because Jo Pavey herself was a qualified physiotherapist, so it interests me. She wasn't asked to use it, but she speaks out really strong and said, you know, it is, and this is what depresses me as equally, it's depressing as you feel there's so much going on with people doing all sorts of things to the absolute limit. You know, and she's saying basically, you know, why are we, marginal gains comes up here. This word marginal gains, you know, where can we get marginal gains? But like, is it in the spirit of competition? What are the ethics here? And, you know, I was looking at stuff during the week, and this is there is a link here with Tommy Conlon's piece in the Sunday Indo. In the wake of 2012, a whole raft of British sports have been investigated for, you know, bullying or, you know, allegations of mistreatment. British cycling, British swimming, British canoeing, British Athletics, and now the latest one, and this is linked to Tommy's, is British Gymnastics. And it seems to me that when you have, when first of all you base your funding on the winning of medals, and then you base, you know, all your value systems on the winning of medals, it's a very, very fine line between what you're doing and what's ethically right and how you treat athletes. And this is, you know, the headline is they're playing with people's lives. You know, they were basically being used as guinea pigs.
Yes, that's in the guinea pigs line is used. So 91 athletes, as you said, 28 of them had to bail on this thing because they were having bad side effects. And this was based, it's a naturally occurring body acid, the ketone. So I presume it helps in recovery or helps in your performance in some way. And it is naturally occurring, but they made a synthetic version of it. And Oxford University had $10 million of funding from the American Department of Defense so that US Special Forces could operate for longer behind enemy lines with fewer rations. That's what this was ultimately for. It's amazing, actually, how many of these drugs that end up in sport were used in war. Like, meldonium was used by all the Soviet troops. So that's basically, it was the US Special Forces. They wanted them to operate behind enemy lines with fewer rations, so they developed this synthetic. And so in 2012, British Athletics asked all these athletes to sign a non-disclosure agreement, and here, you all take it. And as you said, Cliona, they didn't actually know if the athletes might test positive for this at the Games, which I find extraordinary.
No, but they had checked it out with UK. They checked it out with UK anti-doping and WADA. And that's interesting. If you have to go to anti-drug people to check that what you're doing is kosher, or, you know, where it goes, you know, where are the lines here, you know, between what's right and wrong? And they had checked that the ketones weren't illegal. Internal UK sport memos showed that they could not guarantee it would always be WADA compliant in the future, clearly, you know. So it raises again this thing of winning at all costs and winning, and, you know, how far are people who are involved at the top level of sport prepared to go with athletes and with the sport, and where are we pushing the line of what's right and what's wrong?
To put the counter argument,
it's UK sport. It isn't just some individual coach here.
Sure, you know, no, it's an official program. To put the counter argument out there, so we've talked about the medicalization of sport a lot in the last 15, 20, 30 years and beyond. There is what's illegal, and everybody agrees on that. And then there is the line, and you have to draw an arbitrary line somewhere. Like, so you're allowed to take Panadol. You know, if you want to change that rule, change the rule. You're allowed this synthetic ketone, for instance. If we have drawn the line at a given moment in time and agree that that's the line, what is wrong with going right up to the line?
Well, I suppose I would have issues with where the line is drawn, is because it just seems to get so blurred so easily. And also, it does mean that the people with the most amount of money to invest in science, you know, will be the people who will make the biggest, biggest improvements. So it is a very fine line. I agree it's a fine line. I suppose it's just that end of sport has become, that medicalization of sport has become so blurred now that it makes you question why people are pushing it to that limit. You know, we're not, you know, human bodies are not to be experimented on, in my opinion. You know, you can push people to train as hard as they can, and we can use science, but we shouldn't be using athletes as guinea pigs. And also, you know, I'm suspicious of anything that has a non-disclosure, you know, in it. Everything that sporting bodies do should be completely transparent. And we've seen, you know, across world sport that when they're not transparent, that's when we get, you know, cheating, drug taking, or corruption with money. Mm. You know, transparency has to be the key in everything in governance. And that's where I'd have the big, big issue here. And also, I just, the notion that anybody can play, you know, God with athletes' bodies and tell them then, you know, don't tell anybody about this and persuade them that it's right, you know, that this is going to be okay. It's worrying for me. And I just, you know, this is where top level sport has got to.
Tommy Conlon then, and it ties in with this. So, sorry, Colm, sorry, come in.
Just reading through this here, and what jumps out, obviously, is the non-disclosure agreement. Why would they be obliged to sign that, Cliona? Why would that be... Why, if it's okay, and the UK sports, quote the piece, quotes a UK sports person's sport spokesperson saying, The project received independent ethical approval. Additionally, UK anti-doping confirmed in writing after seeking clarification from WADA that WADA has no reason to consider such substances as banned under the 2011 list of prohibited substances and methods. Why a non-disclosure agreement then?
Would the, that's exactly my question, you know. You know, was it was it linked to their funding? What was it, you know, we don't know why they that was enforced, but the minute you see it, you're suspicious, you know.
Maybe it says it might say it in the bigger piece, I'm not sure. It doesn't say it in this piece. It is the question, isn't it?
Why go to that level, and it's not addressed, or it's certainly not the piece I'm looking at in the Irish Mail on Sunday, and I don't have the access to the. I don't see why it's here, and that's a key thing.
At its most innocent, it could be to do with keeping a competitive advantage in their eyes legal, but not letting other nations know that this is an option. And then at its more sinister end, well, who knows?
In case things go wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Tommy Collins' piece is linked to all of this. Athletes are vulnerable. They will do what it takes. They are often young people. They are listening to those in authority. I think most of us are familiar with Larry Nassar. He was a doctor and medic with American Gymnastics. He abused 150 women that we know of. He has been sentenced to 175 years in jail in Michigan in the U.S., If you have Netflix, Athlete A will have popped up on your home screen over the last while. I've watched about half of it, Cliona. It's pretty chilling. It's pretty horrific stuff. I think people have probably read about Larry Nassar and his crimes. Tommy Collin recounts the short version. You might sum it up for us.
Yeah, well, the reason I'm glad to see this Tommy Collin piece today is because, you know, during the lockdown, you know, The Last Dance, everybody was going on about The Last Dance, The Last Dance, The Last Dance, you know, and I know there was a series and it went on for a long time and everything. But I haven't seen people online or in social media saying, oh, my God, watch Athlete A, watch Athlete A. And I don't know, is that because it's about a minority sport or because it's primarily about a female sport in this end of it. But yeah, I'm surprised that more people haven't been talking about it because I watched it. But then I also had watched you could watch at the time of the Larry Nassar. And Larry Nassar was the doctor for the US gymnastics team and basically was abusing athletes for a very, very long time within that system. And the UK gymnastics is still has a multiple court cases pending because gymnasts allege that they, first of all, they weren't protected at the time, and secondly, they weren't listened to. But it is a shocking, shocking case of basically paedophilia and abuse, sexual abuse. And it has come to light. It's been discussed again in recent days because UK gymnastics have now it's not I would stress that the allegations about UK gymnastics are actually about mistreatment and bullying and coaches abusing children verbally, but it isn't linked to it in a sexual way. But this is Tommy has taken the example anyway to talk about Athlete A, and when Larry Nassar came up in court, you could watch. I watched live because one of the great things about that case was that they allowed all of the victims to come and testify, and you could actually watch it online. I think it was early 2018, and I mean, it was just heartbreaking stuff. It was just incredible, and this, you know, his victims, you know, included so many famous gymnasts, right down, you know, from the top to the bottom level in terms of people on squads. But just, it always struck me that it should have been a bigger story. I think it was the Indianapolis Star, and we covered it on Off the Bench before people were talking about it at all, really, on this side of the world, because we'd spotted it in the Indianapolis Star, and there they did brilliant. And Athlete A, if you watch the documentary on Netflix, it looks at how they discovered it and they followed the case and how they covered it. But it is a sickening watch, but I think it is imperative for people to watch it. And Tommy, the headline is "No darkness should ever shadow the innocence of children at play." And he says at the end of it, while the stories told in Athlete A prompted further discussion this week about the culture in British gymnastics, the echoes from Ireland's horrific past can be heard in them too. And I'm sure that's a reference to Irish swimming, you know, in the past. And as And he says, as for the present and future, and knowing what we know now, there will always be a conflicting ambivalence for those adults willing to volunteer their time in children's sport. No darkness should ever shadow the fun and innocence of children at play, while the grown-ups looking after them can never afford to forget that as well. And, you know, he's basically saying, you know, sports that have very young athletes in them, everybody has to be doubly vigilant, really.
Because even watching the documentary, and Tommy outlines it here, it's a perfect storm. It's a perfect concoction, the world of gymnastics. And I was not totally aware of the history of it and how it had evolved. So, like, he quotes, just to separate the sexual abuse for a second, so Larry Nassar in jail, yeah, horrific, and he wasn't the only paedophile involved in gymnastics, but just ring-fencing that for a second, and just the general atmosphere in gymnastics, which is maybe what the UK story is more about. So he quotes Jennifer Say, top American gymnast in the 80s, and she's written a book about it, and she says the standard methodology of coaching in elite gymnastics is cruelty. And this dates back to Montreal in 1976. So basically it seemed, Kalina, like up until 76, it was, without wanting to, you know, use the word normal, but what you would call normal-looking women of a certain age doing gymnastics. You know, they showed pictures of previous games. And 76, 14-year-old Nadia Comaneci?
Comaneci.
Like, it's famous. She's in Sports Illustrated. Excuse the mispronunciation name. She's 14 years old. She wins. She's a phenomenon. And this sets a new trend of the type of athlete that elite gymnastics goes after. And Jennifer Say talks about it. You know, it created a really dangerous environment. Eating disorders became very prevalent. Delay in menstruation. Delay in maturation. You had to be tiny. You know, effectively, you had to be childlike. And then she goes on to say, there were sexual predators everywhere. And you can see suddenly how these two worlds started to intermingle. And the coaching ticket, who had overseen Nadia, the 14-year-old's win in Montreal, they're recruited by the US. They joined the US system in 81. And they oversee the elite women's gymnastics from there. And it just, like, it's everything you've talked about, cruelty, very vulnerable young women, starving themselves, you know, training hurt and so on. Mm. And then in the midst of all that, Larry Nassar turns up and he's kind, he's funny. He'd sometimes sneak them in food. He created trust with all these women and was allowed to operate as he did for 25 years. Like, it's the most horrific picture of what happened.
If you watch the documentary, and I've followed the case, you know, to the point where he actually sexually abused a gymnast while her mother was in the room while he was massaging her. I mean, that's how evil this man was. Gymnastics has a very interesting history. And I did gymnastics as when I was younger, so I was always, I like Olga Corbett was one of my heroes, and then Nadia Comaneci. But they, I mean, since a lot in recent years, there's a rule now that you can't compete. But these young girls were competing at 13 and 14. You can't compete internationally, you can't compete in the Olympics now until you're, I think, 16, is it, at right. the moment. And all of these things have been done for a reason. First of all, because there was a deep suspicion that in Eastern Europe, they were deliberately delaying menstruation and making sure that girls stayed tiny and small and flexible. And that was one of the problems with gymnastics. So that has changed. And even if you see Simone Biles now, gymnasts now are more powerful. It's all about strength. And, you know, there's a whole ethical thing there. Very interesting. Joan Ryan, brilliant. American writer, wrote a fantastic book called Little Girls in Pretty Boxes, and it was about how badly young girls were treated at the time in elite gymnastics and skating, ice skating. And if anybody's interested in that, it is a brilliant book. I don't know how old it is now, but it blew the lid really on the physical abuse of young girls in these sports back in the, I suppose, 70s and 80s. And if anybody's interested in following, you know, if they are interested in it, that's one well worth reading. But I'm delighted to see Tommy raising it, because I do think that it's a documentary that, you know, is on Netflix, and I haven't heard many people talking about it. I'm delighted to see him raising it.
Colm, anything jumping out at you about all this? I mean, I'm sure lots is, but
I just obviously the scale of it, and it's not a story I have followed that closely, but just the scale of it, and you read that quote, you know, about how he ingratiated himself with, you know, he was kind, he was funny, and that is really the pathway for people like this, and sport is so vulnerable. And this is perhaps the most striking of any case of paedophilia in sport and abuse of that nature. I think it probably is the standout. And it's obviously a feature that will draw people into the Netflix series too. It's certainly one you'd be interested in chasing up on and seeing, delving deeper into it.
It's good as well as important. Like
we should say that child protection issues around children in sport now, you know, they're very clear. You know, a lot in this country, they're very strict as well. And as Colm knows, even when you're coaching, you know, at club level in GAA or whatever, you have to go through very strict protocols now. And thank God for it, really, because we can never be too careful with children.
Guys, to wrap up before the clock really gets against us, I mean, we won't really have time to get too deep into any of the other stories. On the GAA front, Colm, before you pick out anything which caught your eye, the club v county, September 14th, you must not train, but if you do, make sure you're insured. Debacle, U-turn, last couple of weeks. What were your thoughts as you wrote about it and looked on?
I think it's probably eased away for now. I think it'll become an issue in August as club teams start to drop out. Joe, I think it'll come right back into focus. I think for now, inter-county managers, some, not all, I mean, what the scale of the problem was, I'd say, at a guess, between 8 and 10 counties were maybe training in the late June, early July. I think it was important that the GAA did put some sanction in place, because to leave it out there, it was a bit pointless. And obviously, when clubs start to drop out of their championships, players are at a loose end. So I do think there will be some inter-county training on some scale. Can I interrupt you there?
What scale is too much? Like, for instance, if a county manager wants to get four of his defenders and go down to the local field and work on something, is that okay?
I think so. I think, Joe, what it is, if it does not impact on a club, so if you have an inter-county manager telling club players, no, you can't go and play a league match, or you can't go and play a challenge match, or you cannot go and train, and if you're training with your club, you can only do a half an hour. I think when it impacts on a club like that, then it becomes a big issue for that club. And the club have been advised that they can send in an email directly to Croke Park, and Croke Park will look at that. I'm not so sure how much that will happen, because that then places those particular players in a difficult position in that their club is effectively ratting out the county setup. And that poses a difficulty. Even though it's not the team that's going to be punished in the first place, it will be the chairperson and the team manager. But your point about four players working on tactical issues and all of that, I don't see how that's preventable in any way. I mean, if four players want to get down to a local park or a field like that and work with a coach, I don't see an issue with that once it doesn't impact on the club schedule. Mm. What I do think we are coming towards more is a split season, because one of the things about having club windows, and we've a club window in April, but ideally you might have club windows throughout the summer where you have 2 or 3 weeks where players go back to the clubs. But that's all predicated on enforcement and having regulations around that, and just to have oversight of it. And I think that's the difficulty for the GAA. It's becoming more difficult that these players are being put in them. And I'm of the belief that the majority of inter-county players, and I think the survey from the ESRI on inter-county players in 2016 reflects that, most of them would prefer to be training with their inter-county squads because it's at a higher level. And most inter-county players, a lot of inter-county players see themselves in the elite bracket. And club training is a step down, one way or another. At a certain level, it's fine. But the further down the grade you go, the more you lose out. And it's not easy just to step back up. So whether a month is enough to switch back on for a league campaign and then a championship, I'm not so sure. But certainly the GAA have really put themselves out for the clubs by enforcing this, by putting the sanctions in place, whether they can enforce it now to prevent it later on the summer. But my point is, I think we're looking more and more at a split season where the All-Ireland finals are going to come back even to the end of July and August to allow a proper club season from July. More and more, and I think the last few weeks have shown that the difficulty of trying to enforce some separation between club and county on this watch when it should be club, I don't see how those club windows would work into the future. So it's something I think later on the year will be revisited.
Yeah, and I suppose, and it's Shane McGrath touches on it, and Dennis Walsh does as well, Cliona, we're talking about all this now as if this is our biggest problem with GAA and with sport, and it's not. I mean, COVID is looming large over the whole thing, and unhappy returns is Dennis Walsh's headline. And he cites the situation in West Cork over the past few days. Yeah. Since challenge games permitted as of last week, and championships are due to get underway. And in the case of two neighbouring clubs, they discovered late on Wednesday that some of their players may have been in contact with a person who has since tested positive for COVID-19. And there was a house party as well, which had contributed. So at this stage, both of the clubs had played challenge matches against each other and other teams as well. Yesterday morning, three clubs had been on social media saying they were pausing all activities. Then a fourth club had to do something similar. And this is in the midst of, obviously, the world opening again and cases arising. And, you know, he even cites there are all these protocols, and the GAA will come on and they'll rightly say we've all these protocols and people have to follow best practice. But then there is the reality of a situation. And Dennis talks about a case recently where a club player turned up for training. The club player had been tested for COVID-19, did not tell the team management about the test until after he had taken part in the session. So after the session, he said, by the way, I've just had a test for COVID. It turned out he was COVID positive. Thankfully, the other people he was in close proximity to were subsequently tested, and they didn't test positive. But obviously, it scuppered training, and everything had to be shut down again. And you can take that situation and multiply that across the country, Cliona.
Yeah, I mean, he makes a really good point. And I think Colin probably confirms as well. I mean, there are also clubs who said, we don't actually want to play. I think, wasn't there a few amalgamated clubs in Cork that said, no, we're not going back. And I've talked to players. I talked to one former inter-county player who would be a key player for his club whose wife is pregnant. And he's saying, I don't want to take that risk. And Dennis makes a really important point, because now we're seeing that young, you know, I think the worry is that young people feel they can't get it. And obviously the statistics this week were a bit frightening, because all the new cases, or you know, lots of those new cases were under 44. But his final line is the most important one. And he said that, you know, it'll never be risk-free. We're going back. We're going to start club action next weekend. Everybody can't wait for it. But not messing it up hinges on thousands of players making many thousands of good choices, nothing else. So you can put all the protocols in place, but actually it's really important that the players, you know, do all the social distancing when they're not at training, you know, in their daily lives. This is where it's really important as well.
I'm not aware so far yet whether any of the the members of the Cork teams have come back and tested positive for being a potential contact of someone who was positive. But a North Dublin club has today confirmed, or last night has confirmed, that they have a positive case there. So that's going to be the challenge. How do you isolate teams? How do you isolate players? I think there'll probably be an advisory this week from the GAA on all of this. But they are very much linked into the HSE and their guidelines in terms of contacting, and who do the contact tracers establish are the actual contacts, close contacts and casual contacts of a player in a match and training context. So that's probably going to become a lot clearer. But the more games that are going to take place, and the more cross-pollination between players or between teams and crossover, we're going to see more of this. And will it lead to teams being excluded from championships at some stage up the way? I'd imagine that's a possibility. And, you know, I think there's a little slight bit more pessimism around this week about the return to play. And maybe we have, I think it's pretty clear, we have been jumping ahead of ourselves a little bit in terms of structures and club and county of all that. It's still very fraught and not very clear whether the seasons, both club and inter-county, will get to their conclusion, because you can see the cases are, you know, they're in their 20s. New cases during the last couple of days have been in their 20s, and you wonder with people that some counties have issued advisories to clubs about players coming back from holidays, and I'm aware of a case where a player came back from holidays and never mentioned it, and I'm aware of a case as well in that respect. So I'd be by no means absolutely certain that's the the framework for games and competitions will remain in place.
I would share the pessimism, but like, let's be honest, we're patting ourselves on the back. Look at how we're behaving as a country. If you go into a shop, what percentage of people are wearing a mask? Like 10%? We're seeing house parties, we're seeing people going on holidays, we're just seeing a general, this thing's over, it's behind us. Like, we're walking right back into it again.
Yeah, as Colm says, we're all so excited at the thought of it coming back, but I think we're being presumptuous to think that it's going to be as straightforward as even the roadmap that's marked out. And that roadmap for the GA, I think, is a very, very problematic one, because you're squeezing club championship and you're squeezing the inter-county championship. And if there's any cases and places have to be closed down, that whole schedule could get badly redone. So, you know, I think we're far from certain that we're going to see what we think we're going to see.
And the way that the games are being scheduled is, in some cases, if you take Wexford Hurling Championship, it's week on week. So if there's a positive case, let's say, and Wexford have a very low, the county of Wexford has been the second lowest, only Leitrim is lower than Wexford in terms of confirmed cases. But if you have a confirmed case, let's say, in Wexford, and they are literally going week on week to conclude on Sunday, the 23rd of April, I mean, what happens in that situation to a team that's still involved and they have a case or maybe two cases or whatever it is, that becomes a problem.
Yeah. Okay. Clock right against us. I mean, you guys have picked out tons of other stuff, from Eamon Sweeney on the Black Lives Matter movement to Jonathan Northcroft on Bruno Fernandes, Bryson DeChambeau, Dermot Leese, Lee Miles' interview with Dermot Crowe, and there's a pullout section in the Times, a hurling pullout, 20 pages.
Yeah.
If I gave you each one thing to sum up and nod towards as a finale, What do you want to go for, Cliona? What do you want to mention?
I really like Dermot Crowe's piece with Liam Miles. I think that's worth reading. If people read it, they'll find out. But he's 73-year-old, still playing hurling. And there's a few beautiful lines in it. And one of them is, I get the notion one year that I wouldn't bother anymore. And then, by Jesus, I go out, explains Miles. Now, 55 years out of minor.
God, 73 and still
great
playing.
Great line. fabulous. Really, really lovely piece. Really lovely piece.
Was he a county player, Cliona? Was he a county player or is he just a long-serving club man?
Yeah, no, he was a Tipperary footballer and then went up and was a very successful hurler as well, and actually fell in love with hurling even more. And it's actually a piece also that reflects what the GAA and other sporting organisations, including the Ladies Gaelic Football, are doing in terms of keeping older people playing and the sort of programmes they're running to keep older people playing. There's one I didn't know of. In Belfast Falls Road, a group of hurlers have been gathering before the lockdown each Thursday for social hurling. They trade under the name Half Pace Hurling, which sort of sounds like the scene from Father Ted, but the whole point of all of this is it doesn't matter as long as you're out enjoying yourself and having fun. And I love to see those stories about older people going back to sport or continuing to play sport in a different format, even if it isn't as competitive.
Colm, any last story you want to give a nod to?
I suppose I've mentioned the Sunday Times supplement on hurling. I mean, it's 25 years since Clare won the Munster title, and it's probably pegged to that. And it's written by the Sunday Times GA writers, the greatest era we've known, and it charts through, obviously, the Brian Cody era, but very much starting with Clare in 1995 and their victory in the Munster final and subsequently the All-Ireland final. But the Munster final especially was the big breakthrough there. So a lot of work has gone into that. I'd also mention the Bryson DeChambeau piece as well from Dermot Gleeson, where he clearly outlines that there were big hitters before, and Jack Nicklaus slimmed down, took 6 inches off his waist in 1970 to win the Open 50 years ago. And, you know, players were working their bodies in different ways back then as well to try and gain an edge. And Nicklaus smashed one 360 yards or something like that back then, obviously with a different ball, different equipment, and all of that. So he's saying it is not unique for someone like DeChambeau to come onto the scene in golf and do something that's really, really different. And he points to the Nicklaus example from half a century ago.
Yeah, this very day, I think he drove the green at St Andrews the 18th.
Yeah.
We had Padraig Harrington on the Golf Weekly podcast earlier this week. He was stunningly, stunningly insightful on this whole area. It's, if you're interested in the DeChambeau thing, it's worth a look. Just look up the Golf Weekly podcast. And he told a great story about being with DeChambeau a year ago on the range. And his contention is DeChambeau always had this power. and is only choosing to unleash it now. And the gain in weight is about protecting his body as much as anything. But that's waiting for you. Guys, thanks so much. Sorry, Cliona, yeah?
Just one last thing. There isn't anything in the actual physical papers today about Barry Geraghty retiring, but there is online, and it probably says everything we need to know about how brilliant Barry Geraghty was, and Colm knows that as a Meath man, but also how humble he was that he chose to retire. I think was at 11 o'clock last night on Twitter.
I mean, of all the news days, Barry, you really picked one.
He picked a good week, but he was a phenomenal jockey, and now that's McCoy, Ruby Walsh and Barry Geraghty, and really from that era of great jockeys, and that is a golden era. That's a golden era of great, great Irish jockeys. And we can put Davy Russell in there, and Paul Carberry also. This has been a phenomenal era, and Geraghty was right up there. He won every big race, and indeed he is leading champion hurdle winning jockey, and also the Queen Mother Champion Chase. He won 5 times. He's won 2 Gold Cups. Maybe wasn't successful as Walsh and Cheltenham, but he rode so many big race winners and some great horses, Moscow Flyer, Sprinter, Sacra. Bob's Worth, he really was, has been a phenomenal jockey in a great era of Irish jockey, the greatest era of Irish jockeys.
Okay, well, that's a good note to finish on. Colm Keyes from the Irish Independent, Cliona Foley, sports journalist, Off the Bench podcast as well. Thanks so much. Enjoy your Sunday afternoon, guys.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks, Cliona.
And I should mention as well, on the hurling theme, Arthur O'Dea on the Off the Ball website has interviewed David Herity, goalkeeper, All-Ireland winner with Kilkenny, and he's given incredible insights into life under Cody. If you want to check that out, that's at the Off the Ball website.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.